This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, I'm Philip Z, and welcome to the Breakfast Grill. On today's Breakfast Grill, we are in conversation with Alice Hill, a David M. Rubenstein Senior Fellow for Energy and the Environment at the Council on Foreign Relations, a think tank based in the United States, as we explore her work on risk, consequences, and responses associated with climate change, as we discuss her latest book, The Fight for Climate After COVID-19. Alice, welcome to the Breakfast Grill.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Must be very chilly over there at Washington, D.C.
It's cold, but it's also unseasonably warm. So that tells us that our climate is continuing to change.
Well, and that's why I would like to ask you a question. What triggered you to write this book? You probably birthed the novel when we were in the midst of the pandemic. Why did you decide to marry these two major catastrophic risks, COVID and climate change?
Well, I have to say it was my boss's idea. The head of the studies department at the Council on Foreign Relations called me up in March 2020 and said, so what's your next big project? And somehow at the end of that call, I believed it was my idea to write a book about pandemics and climate change. But of course, it was his very wise idea. He basically helped me think through how I could meld my experience and what I had learned when I worked at the Department of Homeland Security, which is the third largest agency in the federal government, as well as in the White House. And I worked on both pandemics and climate risks. So seeing the intersections, what we could learn from this pandemic, it was already clear it would be big, and how we could apply that to have better results with climate change.
You know, when you wrote this book and when it came out in September, and at the same time, there was COP26, you saw all these commitments, you saw all these announcements made. Did you think that was progress? Did you think the pandemic had brought the conversation on climate forward or backward?
I'm not sure that COVID was the motivating factor. I do think it gave us a glimpse of how quickly governments can move in the time of crisis. We handed out trillions of dollars to different groups to help them weather these events of the pandemic. Instead, I think the motivator that was occurring in Glasgow was the very important report that was issued in August of this year from the International Panel on Climate Change. That's the group of scientists that inform these negotiations. And that report stated unequivocally, we are heating up, that is the planet, and it's because of human activity. And if we don't contain the heating, we are headed to calamitous, really unimaginable harm going forward. So that was a stark statement. And in fact, all 197 nations that are parties to the UN Framework on Convention on Climate Change agree to that executive summary, which was the summary of the science. And then for many people around the world, if you simply looked out your window or your doorway, you could see climate change impacts already very evident. In fact, we have seen that climate change has arrived probably faster than the scientists originally predicted.
And this reality, I think, was felt stark. And I wanted to pose you this question because, as you were saying, you were once in government, and I would like you to recollect your experience when you were the special assistant to President Barack Obama and senior director for resilience policy on the National Security Council. How did you think government at that time looked at climate change? Because it's changed a lot, isn't it, to where we were at COP26?
Well, one of the challenges then is that we still had, and we still do, frankly, but there's less of it, skepticism about climate change, what it would mean. There was discussion that the costs of trying to contain our carbon would be so much greater than the impacts. That discussion has had more evidence presented, and it's becoming clear that the costs of these impacts are enormous. We simply hadn't figured out how they cascade. So in the United States, if we have a wildfire, it affects health, asthma, respiratory disease. It can add to damage to infrastructure. We discovered that water pipes melt in extreme heat. It contributes to more carbon emissions in the air, and of course leaves people homeless and without livelihoods. So our economic modeling on the cost of these impacts simply hadn't captured how devastating on economic terms, much less the human suffering involved of these events. So we've had more experience, and I think people are beginning to finally recognize this will affect everything, and it will be in large part many negative impacts.
Yeah. And you say there is a case for change, but now the question here is the solutions. In your book, you know, you point out about the collective failure of imagination in tackling this crisis. Can I ask you, why have we become so lazy in thinking of innovative and, you know, creative solutions?
Unfortunately, it's not unique to climate change. The failure of imagination really has been a constant when you look at big events that have caught nations by surprise. That would include, in my nation, 9/11, when we simply didn't anticipate that terrorists could fly planes into buildings and cause them to collapse in one of our largest cities. That was identified in the commission that followed after that terrible event as a failure of imagination. Similarly, again, looking at my country's history, the bombing of Pearl Harbor, which brought the United States into World War II, was identified in the investigations that followed that tragedy, a failure of imagination. So the important thing with climate change is, because it is an unfamiliar risk, it's a risk that essentially no one has experienced at this scale and rapidity, the changes that we are already experiencing, that we find ways to exercise our imagination to force us to be able to recognize and appreciate what could be ahead. And that could be scenario-based planning. It can be tabletop exercises. It can be actually true war games to try to figure out what are the likely moves. Thing is that we remain focused on it.
Yeah, because the goal is to make the risk real, isn't it? That is the big central problem we have. We find it so hard to quantify this risk and even put a number or scale to it, right? On both the pandemic and on climate change. Is that correct?
Absolutely similar. And one of these challenges is the way the human brain works. The way we understand risk is typically tied to what we have experienced or a loved one has experienced. So if we haven't experienced that extreme flood event or heat event or wildfire event, we tend to discount that it will happen to us. That's also because we have a bias that we're optimists, yeah, and that helps us get through life. We think the bad thing's not going to happen to us. Unfortunately, those shortcuts in our decision-making hinder us in imagining these unfamiliar threats that are ahead. So that's why you see people saying so frequently, I've been surprised by this. And then after the event occurs, because it's foremost in their mind, they go out and buy flood insurance, they prepare their homes, they take all sorts of steps in response to the catastrophic risk they've just experienced, their future catastrophic risks they need to prepare for too.
And you make a very interesting point in the book as well, because you said at 3-4 degree world is not insurable, right? You say that for a world where we think we can put a price to everything, that really is a pretty strong statement. You think really what will happen is that nations will really realize that the risk to ensure future climate disasters is so high that it could potentially bankrupt nations, right, as the climate crisis accelerates? Do you think the penny will drop then only?
It depends. It really depends on who the leaders are. And one of the things that we find hinders us in the United States is a phenomenon called NIMT. That stands for not in my term, and the term refers to an elected politician. And so an elected politician who's facing the reports that you need to build gigantic seawalls, or you need to relocate communities to keep them safe, or you're not going to be able to develop that piece of land, may feel, because they're facing a re-election, that they'll turn their attention to more immediate issues that the electorate will be concerned with, which is crime, education, health, those types of things. So we see sometimes the politicians, and many of these decisions are made at the local level in the United States, don't really want to engage because they sense that it might not help their reelection.
Yeah.
So politicians who've been in office longer tend to embrace this issue. And in fact, President Obama in his second term made climate his big issue. He was termed out. He was leaving office. So he embraced it very strongly.
Very interesting point that, you know, as you mature in your political maturity, that people tend to embrace this. Now, in your book, you wrote this wonderful, very famous Malay proverb, Sediakan Payung Sebelum Hujan, which is prepare, get ready the umbrella before the rain. So apt in this time, especially. How good are we in planning?
Well, there are some good exceptions, but I'd say as a general rule, we are struggling with that. And that was very evident here in the United States with our response to the pandemic. We had done planning. We did chose not to follow the plan, or the Trump administration chose not to follow the plan. But we haven't in the United States yet adopted a national adaptation plan, which would in many instances help us prioritize our investments, better explain what role the federal government will play with state and local governments, and really help civil society be much more broadly engaged in these issues. We have some countries that have developed very robust adaptation plans, and we see some major efforts from them in planning for these new extremes.
And this planning does require leadership. And I quote from your book, if a president chooses to ignore advice, it doesn't really matter how you're organized. So tell me, what are the necessary characteristics of leadership necessary to really action to plans?
Well, I think one of the first is courage, because sometimes this is going to be unwelcome news to the electorate. And President Trump, in this instance, when we had the first case in the United States identified, said to the American public, oh, it's just one case. Now, anyone who had worked on pandemics knew that there were probably many cases and that we would be soon overrun with a disease unless we were acting. And telling the American public, we're going to have to take some steps to protect ourselves from this disease. Chose not to do that. He or she needs to listen to experts, and that's particularly important when you're talking about public health as well as climate change, because those experts have the familiarity with the models that can tell us what's ahead, and they can also have familiarity with all the range of resources that are available. So you need to be in consultation with your experts, your scientific experts in particular, to understand these risks. And then I think it's important that you determine if you do have plans, not that you'll follow them to the exact letter, but in the process of creating plans, relationships are built across governments. So people know whom to call, they know what resources are available across those plans. And if you abandon those plans midstream, as we did in the United States, that means all those relationships are not being leveraged. And so there's a lot of scrambling that occurs. Granted, there's always a lot of scrambling, but far more if you've basically tossed the plan and said, we're going to be planning from the get-go as this event unfolds.
Yeah.
You may have to do that in a really, truly surprise event, but if we've already created a plan, it's a good thing to consult that at the very first moment.
On The Breakfast Grill, I'm in conversation with Alice Hill as we discuss her latest book, The Fight for Climate After COVID-19. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back. On The Breakfast Grill, we have Alice Hill. She's a David M. Rubenstein Senior Fellow for Energy and the Environment at the Council on Foreign Relations. She's in the hot seat as we discuss the interrelationship and the dynamics between the pandemic and climate change. You talk about a concurrent, consecutive and compounding disasters. And I just want to share with you a personal experience that we are having over here in Malaysia. We saw, I think, in the worst in 50 years flash flood that affected our valley, you know, with nearly 60 or 80 over 1,000 people displaced. But it's compounded with the pandemic, and we're seeing cases rise there. So how does the plan work? How does leadership make that work? You know, we're scratching our heads, aren't we?
It's very difficult, but that's why it's so important to make sure that we get in situations where we have a panoply of possibilities put before us to stretch our imaginations beyond what's immediately before us. You know, this scenario-based planning came out of an idea from Hollywood. The RAND Corporation is one of our government kind of think tanks. It sits right on the coast in Santa Monica, right next to LA. And one of the researchers there, Dr. Herman Kahn, was trying to figure out how can we help people get over this lack of imagination problem. And he decided to borrow from Hollywood where they do scenes. And he said, we're going to create scenes, not that they tell you everything, but they can begin this discussion among people to figure out what kind of planning do we need to be able to have a robust, resilient response as new events unfold. And this has become much more widely used in industry, in the financial industry. Shell Corporation has been using it for over 50 years.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And when you do all these scenarios, then you realize you have to do a couple of things, as you mentioned in the book as well. Acting before disaster strikes, fashioning supply chains, stock planning, planning to search. You know, all these actions are key, but it will also come with a cost, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And climate change is coming with cost. So if you just want to run on efficiency, you may find yourself very vulnerable. We have to build redundancy in the system because the system will be stressed, as you've just said, by multiple simultaneous compounding events. And if we don't haven't invested in redundancy, one break in the chain causes everything to collapse. Mm. We've seen that very graphically with supply chains, frankly, during the pandemic.
That's right. I think the pandemic has even made the situation worse. And you also call for the need to weave better safety nets for vulnerable populations across the world. Can you give us some examples of countries that have done a pretty good job in actually putting in place the right safety nets for their populations, especially those that are vulnerable?
Well, Brazil was a leader in this and trying to help get money out to poor families. And they found that they could tie that money to certain outcomes that they desired, the kids remaining in school, other health, getting health checkups. So their population was healthier. That seems like a wise investment. We have seen forecast-based insurance become much more prevalent, particularly in the developing world in Africa. It was first showcased or used in Uganda. There was the way this works is you get a forecast of a big storm, more flooding coming. And because there's a recognition that if people don't have money to evacuate, they can't get out of the way of the storm. And if they don't have money to protect their homes, their livelihoods, after the storm, they are going to suffer. And often it's the children who suffer. They don't have enough to eat. And particularly the girls and children are pulled out of school when livelihood of the family's lost. So get money out right in advance of the storm so they can move goods to high ground. They can invest in materials to protect their precious investments. And we find that that means that the populations are a lot safer.
I find it very interesting that the examples you cite are from developing nations, actually, which I think brings a lot of hope that it can be adopted anywhere and everywhere. But you also call for a very important push, and I think that's actually the central theme of your book, which is how do we jumpstart resilience? I mean, it is so hard, isn't it, for us to think about the word resilience. Even that also creates a lot of fatigue for many of us who have, you know, weathered this pandemic. So how do we honestly, you know, jumpstart resilience in the organization and within the communities we live in?
I think we start with the things that will be immediately of benefit to people. And one that we are seeing all countries need improvement on is early warning. Some countries have made great advances. I will call out Bangladesh, which in 1970 had a terrible cyclone that killed 500,000 people. It wasn't Bangladesh at that time. It was East Pakistan. After that terrible event, civil unrest, and Bangladesh has invested deeply in early warning systems. In 1993, I believe, they had a terrible cyclone. Again, less loss of life. And then in 2007, in Cyclone Cedar, still thousands dying. Last year, we had Cyclone Amphon, and the deaths were just so much lower because of early warning. They go out on rickshaws and bicycles with megaphones and tell everyone to take shelter, and they have a very advanced sheltering system. So we know that early warning works, but we've seen, for example, in Europe, in Germany, with these flash floods, The early warning system didn't work as planned. We've seen that in the United States with wildfires. The early warning system didn't work as we intended. So that's an area that we need great investment in, but really we need even more in the developing world. Over, according to the World Meteorological Organization, over 100 countries lack viable early warning systems for multi-hazard.
Yeah, and especially, and we expect extreme weather systems to persist and also accelerate in the coming decades ahead. You know, you in your book, you also bring up a lot of examples, and Japan is cited as a role model, I think, but a role model in a very interesting way in how they memorialize, how they commemorate losses. Why is it so important for us to memorialize natural disasters, for us to see the pain still present and physical?
Because it helps us get over the failure of imagination. And it's very interesting to me. As I did the research for this book, I realized that with the 1918 pandemic, there were almost no memorials built, even though there was massive deaths across the globe from that influenza. And that is one reason why people may not have appreciated that we were just as vulnerable to a pandemic, if not more. In fact, in 2017, in the 99th anniversary of the 1918 flu, I wrote a piece saying, watch out, we could have another really big pandemic. But it's hard to get anyone's attention.
Yeah.
If you have it as part of your education, as the Japanese do, and then they build on that, they have preparedness days, they have exercises, drilling that are used, built around prior bad events, it keeps it forefront of the people who have suffered it, but also for new generations who haven't suffered it. And the Japanese realize we are turning over as population and that memory is getting lost unless we pay very close attention. The Dutch do the same thing, and they are also among the very best water engineers in the world because they focus so much on past floods and what we can do to avoid that threat in the future.
We started the conversation on the lack of imagination, and I think we'd like to end on that. And I wonder whether it's this lack of imagination that's causing us to think binary, which is we can only mitigate, but we cannot adapt. That we should do both, right? We need to mitigate and adapt. Is the challenge that so much resources has been put into mitigation that we've completely forgotten how to emphasize on the adaptation side?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I think I have heard more the opposite. I have heard, oh, we can adapt. Well, that's what humans have always been doing. We've been adapting and we'll be safe. But we haven't been adapting to events occurring in every corner of the globe at this scale and magnitude and as damaging as these are. So I think that underestimates the challenge ahead. The split in the mitigation and adaptation, I have observed this ever since I started working on climate change and I entered on the adaptation side. I think part of it was that no one imagined we wouldn't have the success that would avoid us having to talk about this. So if we look back, we've been holding these Conference of the Parties, the COPs, for over a quarter of a century. Everyone hoped that we would have this under control. We don't. And therefore, it's somewhat, in some camps, viewed as kind of a defeat that we have to talk about adaptation. Whatever the reasons are, we really need to pay close attention to how these two facets of climate change and response interact with one another so that we don't make choices in one area that could undermine the choices in the other. So these two communities now need to work together in a way they ever haven't had to in the past, because it's no longer theoretical. We're making choices that are affected by climate change risks and that we hope will work to cut down the overall risk.
You know, this has been a wonderful interview, but I hope to interview you in 2 years' time for your next book. What would you like the title of your next book to be?
Well, I actually have a working title, Adaptation from the Ground Up. I want to explore all the lessons that we are seeing. One of the challenges with adaptation is it's so localized because these impacts come in. You've just described flash flooding in your community. It might be a heat wave. You might not be worrying about drought. Some other community is worrying about drought and desertification. So how do we take these disparate responses and make them accessible to the many communities who are experiencing similar threats, but don't have an opportunity to learn from each other. Essentially, right now, what's happening is we're asking each community to figure out their own response, reinvent the wheel without sharing the huge amount of information we are developing in many locations. And importantly, many of these solutions come from the developing world, which have fewer protections than the developed world. So they have already started making some important improvements that the developing world could learn from.
Alice, thank you so much. Very enlightening conversation. That's all the time we have for today on The Breakfast Grill. Alice Hill, as we discuss her latest book, The Fight for Climate After COVID-19. I'm Philip C., BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.